dreams and insights that the universe and humanity had been awaiting. Obviously, I would not be the father of such a second Messiah. The union of the second John Keats Seibert and Braun Lamia had been, by Ania's own accounts, the great reconciliation between the best elements of the Technocore and humanity itself. It had taken the abilities and perceptions of both AIs and human beings to create the hybrid ability to see directly into the void which binds, for humanity finally to learn the language of the dead and of the living. Empathy was another name for that ability, and Ania had been the child of empathy, if any title suited her. Who could the father of her child be? The answer struck me like a thunderbolt. For a second, there in the Schrödinger cat box, I was so shaken by the logic of it that I was sure that the particle detector clicking away periodically in the frozen energy wall of my prison had detected the emitted particle at exactly the right time and the cyanide had been released. What irony to figure things out and to die in the same moment. But it was not poison in the air. Only the growing strength of my certainty on this matter and the even stronger impulse to some action. There was one other player in the cosmic chess game Ania and the others had been playing for 300 standard years now. That near-mythical observer from the alien sentient races, whom Ania had mentioned briefly in several different contexts. The lions and tigers and bears. The being so powerful that they could kidnap old Earth to the lesser Magellanic Cloud rather than watch it be destroyed, had, according to Ania, sent among us one or more observers over the past few centuries. Entities who had, according to my interpretation of what Ania had said, taken on human form and walked among us for all this time. This would have been relatively easy during the Pax era with the virtual immortality of the cruciform so widespread. And there were certainly others who, like the ancient poet Martin Silenus, had stayed alive through a combination of world-web-era medicine, Poulsen treatments, and sheer determination. Martin Silenus was old, that was certain, perhaps the oldest human being in the galaxy. But he had not been the observer, that was equally certain. The author of the Kantos was too opinionated, too active, too visible to the public at large, too obscene, and generally just too damned cantankerous to be a cool observer, representing alien races so powerful that they could destroy us in an eye blink. Or so I hoped. But somewhere, probably somewhere I had never visited and could not imagine, that observer had been waiting and watching in human form. It made sense that Ania might have been compelled, by both prophecy and the necessity of unhindered human evolution she had taught about and believed in, to cast away from her odyssey to that distant world where the observer waited, meet him, mate with him, and bring that child into the universe. Thus would be reconciled the core, humanity, and the distant others. The idea was unsettling, definitely disturbing to me, but also exciting in a way that nothing had been since Ania's death. I knew Ania. Her child would be a human child, filled with life and laughter and a love of everything from nature to old holodramas. I had never understood how Ania could have left her child behind, but now I realized that she would have had no choice. She knew the terrible fate that awaited her in the basement cell of Castel Sant'Angelo. She knew that she would die by fire and torture while surrounded by inhuman enemies and the Nemes monsters. She had known this since before she was born. The fact of this made my knees weak. How could my dear friend have laughed with me so often, gone optimistically into new days so happily, celebrated life so thoroughly, when she knew that every day passing was another day closer to such a terrible death? I shook my head at the strength of will this implied. I did not have it, this I knew. Ania had. But she could not have kept the child with her, knowing when and how this terrible ending would take place. Presumably, then, the father was raising the child, the other in human form, the observer. I found this even more upsetting than my earlier revelations. I was struck then with the additional certainty that Aeneia would have wanted me to have some role in her child's life if she had thought it possible. Her own glimpses into possible futures presumably ended with her own death. Perhaps she did not know that I would not be executed at the same time. But then, she had asked me to scatter her ashes on old earth, which assumed my survival. Perhaps she had thought it too much of a request to make, for me to find her child and to help in any way I could as the boy or girl came of age, to help protect it in a universe of sharp edges. I realized that I was weeping, not softly but with great ragged sobs. It was the first time I had wept like this since Aeneia's death, and, oddly enough, it was not primarily out of grief for Aeneia's absence, but at the thought of the second chance to hold a child's hand as I had once held Aeneia's when she was still 12 standard, of protecting this child of my beloved's as I had tried to protect my beloved, and failed. The indictment was my own. Yes, I had failed to protect Aeneia in the end, but she knew that I would fail, that she would fail in her quest to bring down the Pax. She had loved me and loved life while knowing that we would fail. There was no reason I had to fail with this other child. Perhaps the Observer would welcome my help, my sharing of the human experience, with this almost certainly more than human little boy or girl. I felt it safe to say that no one had known Aeneia better than I had. This would be important for the child's, for the new Messiah's upbringing. I would bring this narrative, now sitting useless in my scriber, and share bits and pieces of it with the boy or girl as he or she grew older, giving it all to him or her someday. I picked up the slate and scriber and paced back and forth in my Schrodinger cell. There was this small matter of my unavoidable execution. No one was coming to rescue me. The explosive shell of the egg had decided that, and if there were a way around that problem, someone would have been here by now. It was the most staggering improbability and good luck that I had survived this long, when every few hours there was another crapshoot with death, as the detector sniffed for the particle emission. I had beaten the laws of quantum chance for this long, but the luck could not hold. I stopped in my pacing. There had been four steps in Aeneia's teaching of our race's new relationship with the void which binds. Even before coming to my cell, I had experienced, if not mastered, learning the language of the dead and of the living. I had shown in my writing of the narrative that I could gain access to the void for at least old memories of those still living, even if the shell somehow interfered with my ability to sense what was happening now with friends such as Father DeSoya or Rachel or Lomo or Martin Silenus. Or was there interference? Perhaps I had subconsciously refused to try to contact the world of the living, at least for anything beyond memories of Aeneia. Since I knew that I now inhabited the world of the dead. No longer. I wanted out of here. There were two other steps that Aeneia had mentioned in her teaching but never fully explained. Hearing the music of the spheres and taking the first step. I now understood both these concepts. Without seeing Aeneia cast, and without that great rush of Gestalt understanding that had come with the terrible sharing of her death, I would not have understood. But I did now. I had thought of hearing the music of the spheres as a sort of paranormal radio telescope trick. Actually hearing the pop and crack and whistle of the stars as radio telescopes had for 11 centuries or more. But that had not been what Aeneia had meant at all, I realized. It was not the stars she was listening to and for, but the resonance of those people, human and otherwise, who dwelt among and around those stars. She had been using the void as a sort of directional beacon before farcasting herself. Much of her personal casting had not made sense to me. The core-controlled farcaster doors had been rough holes torn through the void, and thus through space-time, held open by the portals that were like crude clamps holding open the raw edges of a wound in the old days of scalpel surgery. Aeneia's farcasting, I now understood, was an infinitely more graceful device. I had wondered, in the busy time when Aenea and I were free-casting down to planet surfaces and from star system to star system in the Yggdrasil, how she had avoided having us blink into existence inside a hill or 50 meters above the surface, or the tree ship inside a star. It seemed to me that blind free-casting, like unplanned Hawking drive jumps, would be haphazard and disastrous. But we had always emerged exactly where we had to be when Aenea cast us. Now I saw why. Aenea heard the music of the spheres. She resonated with the void which binds, which resonates in turn to sentient life and thought. And then she used the almost illimitable energy of the void to take the first step, to travel via the void to where those voices waited. Aenea had once said that the void tapped into the energy of quasars, of the exploding centers of galaxies, of black holes and black matter. Enough, perhaps, to move a few organic life forms through space-time and deposit them in the proper place. Love was the prime mover in the universe, Aenea had once said to me. She had joked about being the Newton who someday explained the basic physics of that largely untapped energy source. She had not lived to do so. But I saw now what she had meant and how it worked. Much of the music of the spheres was created by the elegant harmonies and chord changes of love, free casting to where one's loved one waits. Learning a place after having traveled there with the one or ones you love. Loving to see new places. Suddenly, I understood why our first months together had been what had seemed at the time like useless farcaster wanderings from world to world. Mare Infinitus, Cumriad, Hebron, Saldraconi Septim, the unnamed world where we had left the ship, all of the others, even old Earth. There had been no working farcaster portals. Aenea had swept Abetic and me with her to these places, touching them, sniffing their air, feeling their sunlight on her skin, seeing them all with friends, with someone she loved, learning the music of the spheres so that it could be played later. And my own solo odyssey, I thought. The kayak farcasting from old Earth to Lucis and the cloud planet and all the other places. Aenea had been the energy behind that casting, sending me to places so that I could taste them and find them again someday on my own. I had thought, even as I wrote the narrative in the Scriber that I held under my arm there in the Schrödinger death cell, that I had been little more than a fellow traveler in a series of picaresque adventures. But it had all held a purpose. I had been a lover traveling with my love. Or to my love, through a musical score of worlds, a score that I had to learn by heart, so that I could play it again some day. I closed my eyes in the Schrödinger cat box and concentrated, then went beyond concentration to the empty mind state I had learned in meditation on Tian Shan. Every world had its purpose. Every minute had its purpose. In that unhurried emptiness, I opened myself to the void which binds and the universe to which it resonated. I could not do this, I realized, without communion with Aenea's blood, without the nanotech-tailored organisms that now dwelt in my cells and would dwell in my children's cells. No, I thought at once, not my children, but in the cells of those in the human race who escaped the cruciform, in their children's cells. I could not do this without having learned from Aenea. I could not have heard the voices I heard then, greater choruses than I had ever heard before, without having honed my own grammar and syntax of the language of the dead and living during the months I worked on the narrative while waiting to die. I could not do this, I realized, if I were immortal. This degree of love of life and of one another is granted, I saw for once and forever, not to immortals. But to those who live briefly and always under the shadow of death and loss. As I stood there, listening to the swelling chords of the music of the spheres, able now to pick out separate star voices in the chorus, Martin Silenus's, still alive but failing on my home world of Hyperion, Theo's on beautiful Maui Covenant, Rachel's on Barnard's World, Colonel Cassad's on Red Mars, Father DeSoya's on Pacham, and even the lovely chords of the dead. Demria's on Vitus Gray Balianus B. Dear Father Glaucus's on cold Sol Draconi Septum. My mother's voice, again on distant Hyperion. I also heard John Keats's words, in his voice, and in Martin Silenus's, and in Aeneas. But this is human life. The war, the deeds, the disappointment, the anxiety. Imagination struggles, far and nigh, all human, bearing in themselves this good, that they are still the air, the subtle food, to make us feel existence, and to show how quiet death is. Where soil is, men grow, whether to weeds or flowers. But for me, there is no depth to strike in. But the opposite was true of me at that moment. There was more than enough depth to strike in. The universe deepened at that moment. The music of the spheres grew from a mere chorus to a symphony as triumphant as Beethoven's Ninth, and I knew that I would always be able to hear it when I wished or needed to. Always be able to use it to take the step I needed to see the one I loved, or, failing that, step to the place where I had been with the one I loved, or, failing that, find a place to love for its own beauty and richness. The energy of quasars and exploding stellar nuclei filled me then. I was borne up on waves of energy more lovely and more lyrical even than the ouster angel's wings seen sliding along corridors of sunlight. The shell of deadly energy that was my prison and execution cell seemed laughable now. Schrödinger's original joke, a child's jump rope laid around me on the ground as restraining walls. I stepped out of the Schrödinger cat box and out of Armagast system. For a moment, feeling the confines of the Schrödinger prison fall away and behind me forever, existing nowhere and everywhere in space, but remaining physically intact in my body and stylus and scriber, I felt a surge of sheer exhilaration as powerful as the dizzying effect of solo farcasting itself. Free! I was free! The wave of joy was so intense that it made me want to weep, to shout into the surrounding light of no space, to join my voice with the chorus of voices of the living and dead, to sing along with the crystal clear symphonies of the spheres, rising and plunging like a solid, acoustic surf all around me. Free at last! And then I remembered that the one reason to be free, the one person who would make such freedom worthwhile, was gone. Aeneas was dead. The sheer joy of escape faded suddenly and absolutely, replaced by a simple but profound satisfaction at my release from so many months of imprisonment. The universe might have had the color drained out of it for me, but at least now I was free to go anywhere I wanted within that monotone realm. But where was I going? Floating on light, free-casting into the universe with my stylus and scriber tucked under my arm, I still had not decided. Hyperion? I had promised to return to Martin Silenus. I could hear his voice resonating strong in the void, past and present, but it would not be part of the current chorus for long. His life remaining could now be counted in days or less. But not to Hyperion, not yet. The biosphere star tree? I was shocked to hear that it still existed in some form, although Lomo's voice was absent from the choral symphony there. The place had been important to Aeneas and me, and I had to return someday. But not now. Old Earth? Amazingly, I heard the music of that sphere quite clearly, in Aeneas' former voice and in mine, in the song of the friends at Taliesin, with whom we had tallied there. Distance meant nothing in the void which binds. Time there seasons but does not destroy. But not to old Earth, not now. I heard scores of possibilities, more scores of voices I wanted to hear in person, people to hug and weep with. But the music I reacted to most strongly now was from the world where Ania had been tortured and killed. Pacham. Home of the church and nest of our enemies. Not, I saw now, the same thing. Pacham. There was, I knew, nothing of Ania for me on Pacham but ashes of the past. But she had asked me to take her ashes and spread them on old earth. Spread them where we had laughed and loved most well. Pacham. In the vortex of void energy, already stepping beyond the Schrödinger cell, but existing nowhere else except as pure quantum probability, I made my decision, and freecast for Pacham. Chapter 33. The Vatican is broken as surely as if the fist of God had smashed down from the sky in an anger beyond human understanding. The endless bureaucratic city around it is crushed. The spaceport is destroyed. The grand boulevards are slagged and melted and rimmed with ruin. The Egyptian obelisk that had stood at the center of St. Peter's Square has been snapped off at the base, and the scores of colonnades around the oval space are tumbled like petrified logs. The dome of St. Peter's Basilica is shattered and has fallen through the central loggia and grand facade to lie in pieces on the broken steps. The Vatican wall is tumbled down in 100 places, completely missing for long stretches. The buildings once protected within its medieval confines, the Apostolic Palace, the secret archives, the barracks of the Swiss Guard, St. Mother Teresa's Hospice, the papal apartments, the Sistine Chapel, are all exposed and smashed, scorched and tumbled and scattered. Castel Sant'Angelo on this side of the river has been slagged. The towering cylinder, 20 meters of towering stone rising from its huge square base, has been melted to a mound of cooled lava. I see all this while walking along the boulevard of broken slabs on the east side of the river. Ahead of me, the bridge, the Ponte Sant'Angelo, has been cracked into 3 sections and dropped into the river. Into the river bed, I should say, for it looks as if the new Tiber has been boiled away, leaving glass where the sandy river bottom and riverbanks had been. Someone has rigged a rope suspension bridge across the debris-filled gap between the banks. This is Pacham, I do not doubt it. The thin, cool atmosphere feels and tastes the same as when Father DeSoya, Ania, and I came through here on the day before my dear girl died. Although it was raining and gray then, and now the sky is rich with a sunset that manages to make even the broken, fallen-away dome of St. Peter's look beautiful. It is almost overwhelming to be walking free under an open sky after my uncounted months of tight incarceration. I clutch my scriber to me like a shield, like some talisman, like a Bible, and walk the once-proud boulevard with shaky legs. For months my mind has been sharing memories of many places and many people. But my own eyes and lungs and legs and skin have forgotten the feeling of real freedom. Even in my sadness, there is an exultation. Freecasting had been superficially the same as when Ania had freecast us both, but on a deeper level it was profoundly different. The flash of white light had been the same, the ease of sudden transition, the slight shock of different air pressure or gravity or light. But this time, I had heard the light rather than seen it. I had been carried up by the music of the stars and their myriad worlds and chosen the one to which I wanted to step. There had been no effort on my part, no great expenditure of energy, other than the need to focus and to choose carefully. And the music had not faded completely away. I guessed that it never would. But even now played in the background, like musicians practicing just beyond the hill for a summer evening's concert. I can see signs of survivors in the city-wide wreckage. In the gold distance, 2 ox carts move along the horizon with human silhouettes walking behind. On this side of the river, I can see huts, simple brick homes among the tumbles of old stone, a church, another small church. From somewhere far behind me comes the smell of meat cooking on an open fire and the unmistakable sound of children laughing. I am just turning toward that smell and sound when a man steps out from behind a mass of debris that may have once been a guard post at the entrance to Castel Sant'Angelo. He is a small man, quick of hand, his face half hidden behind a beard and his hair combed back to a queue, but his eyes are alert. He carries a solid slug rifle of the sort once used for ceremony by the Swiss Guard. We stare at each other for a moment, the unarmed, weakened man carrying nothing but a scriber, and the sun-bronzed hunter with his ready weapon. And then each recognizes the other. I have never met this man, nor he me, but I have seen him through others' memories via the void which binds, although he was uniformed, armored, and clean-shaven the first time I saw him, naked and in the act of being tortured the last time. I do not know how he recognizes me, but I see that recognition in his eyes an instant before he sets the weapon aside and steps forward to seize my hand and forearm in both his hands. "Roland Dimion," he cries. "The day has come. Praise be. Welcome." The bearded apparition actually hugs me before stepping back to look at me again and grin. "You're Corporal Key," I say stupidly. I remember the eyes most of all, seen from Father de Soya's point of view as he and Key and Sergeant Gregorius and Lancer Reddick chased Ania and me across this arm of the galaxy for years.
"Formerly Corporal Key," says the grinning man. "Now just Basson Key, citizen of New Rome, member of the Diocese of St. Anne's, hunter for tomorrow's meal."
He shakes his head as he stares at me.
"Rawl Endymion, my God, some thought you would never escape that cursed Schrodinger cat thing."
"You know about the Schrodinger egg?"
"Of course," says Key. "It was part of the shared moment. Ania knew where they were taking you, so we all knew. And we've sensed your presence there through the void, of course."
I felt suddenly dizzy and a bit sick to my stomach. The light, the air, the great distance to the horizon. That horizon became unstable, as if I were looking at it from aboard a small ship in a rough sea. So I closed my eyes. When I opened them, Key was holding my arm and helping me sit on a large white stone that looked as if it had been blasted from the cathedral far across the glass river.
"My God, Rawl," he says. "Have you just freecast from there? You've been nowhere else?"
"Yes," I say. "No." I take two slow breaths and say, "What is the shared moment?" I had heard the formal capital letters in his voice. The small man studies me with his bright, intelligent gaze. His voice is soft.
"Ania's shared moment," he says. "It is what we all call it. Although, of course, it was more than a single moment. All the moments of her torture and death."
"You felt that too?" I say. I suddenly feel a fist closing around my heart, although whether the emotion is joy or terrible sadness remains to be discovered.
"Everyone felt it," says Key. "Everyone shared it. Everyone, that is, except her torturers."
"Everyone else on Pacem?" I ask.
"On Pacem," says Key. "On Lucis and Renaissance Vector, on Mars and Cumriat and Renaissance Minor and Tau Ceti Center, on Fuji and Ixion and Deneb Dre and Sibiatu's Bitterness, on Barnard's World and God's Grove and Mare Infinitus, on Sing Tau Siswang Pana and Patoffa and Groombridge Dyson D."
Key pauses and smiles at the sound of his own litany.
"On almost every world, Rawl, and in places in between. We know that the Star Tree felt the shared moment. All the Star Tree biospheres did."
I blink. "There are other Star Trees?"
Key nods.
"How did all these worlds share that moment?" I ask, seeing the answer even as I pose the question.
"Yes," murmurs the former Corporal Key. "All of the places Ania visited, often with you. All of the worlds where she left disciples who had partaken of communion and renounced the cruciform. Her shared moment, the hour of her death, was like a signal broadcast and rebroadcast through all of these worlds."
I rub my face. It feels numb.
So only those who had already taken communion or studied with Aeneas shared in that moment? I say. Key is shaking his head. No, they were the transponders, the relay stations. They pulled the shared moment from the void which binds and rebroadcast it to everyone. Everyone? I repeat stupidly. Even those tens and hundreds of billions in the packs who wear the cross? Who wore the cross? Amends Basson Key. Many of those faithful have since decided not to carry a core parasite in their bodies. I begin to understand, then. Aeneas' last shared moments had been more than words and torture and pain and horror. I had sensed her thoughts, shared her understanding of the core's motives, of the true parasitism of the cruciform, of the cynical use of human death to tweak their neural networks, of Lord Asami's lust for power and Mustafa's confusion and Albedo's absolute inhumanity. If everyone had shared the same shared moment that I had screamed and fought my way through in the high-G tank on the outward-bound robot prison torch ship, then it had been a bright and terrible moment for the human race, and every living human being must have heard her final, "I love you, Rawl," as the flames swept high. The sun is setting. Rays of gold light shine through the ruins on the west side of the river and throw a maze of shadows across the east bank. The molten mass of Castel Sant'Angelo runs down toward us like a mountain of melted glass. She asked me to spread her ashes on old earth, and I can't even do that for her. I fail her, even in death. I look up at Basson Key. "On Pacham?" I say. She had no disciples on Pacham when... Oh. She had sent Father DeSoya away immediately before our doomed charge up the aisle in St. Peter's Basilica, asking him to leave with the monks and blend into the city he knew so well, to avoid the Pax, whatever else happened. When he had argued, Aeneas' words had been, "This is all I ask, Father, and I ask it with love and respect." And Father DeSoya had gone out into the rain, and he had been the broadcast relay, carrying my darling girl's last agony and insight to several billion people on Pacham. "Oh," I say, still looking at Key, "but the last time I saw you, through the void, you were being kept captive in cryogenic fugue there in that..." I swept my hand in disgust toward the melted heap of Castel Sant'Angelo. Key nods again. "I was in cryogenic fugue, Rawl. I was stored like a sleeping slab of meat in a cold locker in a basement dungeon not far from where they murdered Aeneas. But I felt the shared moment. Every human alive did, whether sleeping or drunk or dying or lost in madness." I can only stare at the man, my heart breaking again in understanding. Eventually, I say, "How did you get out, away from there?" We are both looking at the ruins of the Holy Office headquarters now. Key sighs. "There was a revolution very soon after the shared moment. Many people, the majority here on Pacham, no longer wanted anything to do with the cruciforms and the betrayed church which had implanted them. Some still were cynical enough to make that trade with the devil in exchange for physical resurrection. But millions, hundreds of millions, sought out communion and freedom from the core cross just in the first week. The Pax loyalists attempted to stop them. There was fighting, revolution, civil war." Again, I say, "just like the fall of the Farcasters 3 centuries ago." "No," says Key, "nothing that bad. Remember, once one has learned the language of the dead and the living, it's painful to hurt someone else. The Pax loyalists did not have that restraint, but then they were in the minority everywhere." I gesture toward the world of ruins. "You call this restraint? You call this not so bad?" "The revolution against the Vatican and the Pax and the Holy Office did not do this," says Key grimly. "That was relatively bloodless. The loyalists fled in Archangel starships. Their new Vatican is on a world called Madia, a real shithole of a planet guarded now by half the old fleet and several million loyalists." "Who then?" I say, still looking at the devastation everywhere around us. "The Corps did this," says Key. The Nemes things destroyed the city and then seized 4 Archangel ships, slagged us from space after the Loyalists left. The Corps was pissed off. Probably still is. We don't care. I carefully set the scriber down on the white stone and look around. More men and women are coming out of the ruins, staying a respectful distance from us but watching with great interest. They are dressed in work clothes and hunting garb, but not in bearskins or rags. These are obviously people living in a rough place during a hard time, but not savages. A young blonde boy waves at me shyly. I wave back.
"I never really answered your question," says Key. "The guards released me, released all of the prisoners, during the confusion in the week after the shared moment. A lot of prisoners around this arm of the galaxy found doors opening that week. After communion, well, it's hard to imprison or torture someone else when you end up sharing half their pain through the void which binds. And the Ousters have been busy since the shared moment, reviving the billions of Jews and Muslims and others kidnapped by the Corps, and ferrying them home from the labyrinthine planets to their homeworlds."
I think about this for a minute. Then I say, "Did Father DeSoya survive?" Key grins even more broadly.
"I guess you can say he survived. He's our priest in the parish of St. Anne's. Come on, I'll take you to him. He knows you're here by now. It's only a 5-minute walk."
DeSoya hugs me so fiercely that my ribs ache for an hour. The priest is wearing a plain black cassock and Roman collar. St. Anne's is not the large parish church we had glimpsed in the Vatican, but a small brick and adobe chapel set in a cleared area on the east bank. It seems that the parish consists of about 100 families who make their livelihood hunting and farming in what had been a large park on this side of the spaceport. I am introduced to most of these 100 families as we eat outside in the lighted space near the foyer of the church, and it seems that they all know of me. They act as if they know me personally, and all seem sincerely grateful that I am alive and returned to the world of the living. As night deepens, Key, DeSoya, and I adjourn to the priest's private quarters, a Spartan room adjoining the back of the church. Father DeSoya brings out a bottle of wine and pours a full glass for each of us. "One of the few benefits of the fall of civilization as we know it," he says, "is that there are private cellars with fine vintages everywhere one digs. It is not theft, it is archaeology." Key lifts his glass as if in toast and then hesitates.
"To Aenea?"
he suggests. "To Aenea," say Father DeSoya and I. We drain our glasses and the priest pours more. "How long was I gone?" I ask. The wine makes my face flush, as it always does. Aenea used to kid me about it. "It has been 13 standard months since the shared moment," says DeSoya. I shake my head. I must have spent the time writing the narrative and waiting to die in work sessions of 30 hours or more, interspersed with a few hours of sleep, then another 30 or 40 hours straight. I had been doing what sleep scientists called free-running, losing all connection to circadian rhythm. "Do you have any contact with the other worlds?" I ask. I look at Key and answer my own question. "You must. Basson was telling me about the reaction to the shared moment on other worlds and the return of the kidnapped billions." "A few ships set in here," says DeSoya. "But with the Archangel ships gone, travel takes time. The Templars and Ousters use their tree ships to ferry the refugees home, but the rest of us hate to use the Hawking drive now that we realize how harmful it is to the void medium. And as hard as everyone works to learn it, very few have learned how to hear the music of the spheres well enough to take that first step." "It's not so hard," I say and chuckle to myself as I sip the smooth wine. "It's goddamn hard," I add. "Sorry, Father." DeSoya nods his indulgence. "It is goddamn hard. I feel that I've come close 100 times, but always lose the focus at the last moment." I look at the little priest. "You've stayed Catholic," I say at last. Father DeSoya sips the wine out of an old glass. "I haven't just stayed Catholic, Rawl. I've rediscovered what it means to be Catholic, to be a Christian, to be a believer." "Even after Aenea's shared moment?" I say. I am aware of Corporal Key watching us from the end of the table.
Shadows from the oil lights dance on the warm earth walls. DeSoya nods. I already understood the corruption of the church and its pact with the core, he says very softly. Aeneas' shared insights only underlined what it meant for me to be human and a child of Christ. I am thinking about this a minute later when Father DeSoya adds, There is talk of making me a bishop, but I am quelling that. It is why I have stayed in this region of Pacham, even though most of the viable communities are away from the old urban areas. One look at the ruins of our beautiful tradition across the river reminds me of the folly of staking too much on hierarchy. So there's no pope, I say? No holy father? DeSoya shrugs and pours us all more wine. After 13 standard months of recycled food and no alcohol, the wine is going straight to my head. Monsignor Lucas Odi escaped both the revolution and the core attack and has established the papacy in exile on Madia, the priest says with a sharp tone in his voice. I don't believe that anyone in the former Pax except his immediate defenders and followers in that system honor him as a real pope. He sips his wine. It is not the first time that the Mother Church has had an anti-pope. What about Pope Urban the 16th, I say. Did he die of his heart attack? Yes, says Key, leaning forward and setting his strong forearms on the table. And was resurrected, I say. Not exactly, says Key. I look at the former corporal, waiting for an explanation, but none is forthcoming. I've sent word across the river, says Father DeSoya. Basson's comment should be explained any minute. Indeed, a minute later, the curtains at the entrance to DeSoya's comfortable little alcove are pulled back, and a tall man in a black cassock enters. It is not Lennar Hoyt. It is a man I have never met, but whom I feel that I know well. His elegant hands, long face, large, sad eyes, broad forehead, and thinning silver hair. I stand to shake his hand, to bow, to kiss his ring, something. Ro, my boy, says Father Paul Doré. What a pleasure to meet you. How thrilled we all are that you have returned. The older priest shakes my hand with a firm grip, hugs me for good measure, and then goes to DeSoya's cupboard as if he is familiar with it, finds a jar, pumps water into the sink, washes the jar, pours wine for himself, and sits in the chair opposite Key at the end of the table. We're catching Rawl up on what has happened in the past year and a month of his absence, says Father DeSoya. It feels like a century, I say. My eyes are focused on something far beyond the table and this room. It was a century for me, says the older Jesuit. His accent is quaint and somehow charming, a French-speaking outback world, perhaps. Almost 3 centuries, actually. I saw what they did to you when you were resurrected, I say with the brazenness of the wine in me. Lord Usami and Albedo murdered you so that Hoyt would be reborn again from your shared cruciforms. Father Duray has not actually tasted his wine, but he stares down into the glass as if waiting for it to transubstantiate. Time and time again, he says in a tone that seems more wistful than anything else. It is a strange life, being born just to be murdered. Aeneas would agree, I say, knowing that these men are friends and good men, but not feeling especially friendly to the church in general. Yes, says Paul Duray, and holds up his glass in a silent toast. He drinks. Basson Key fills the vacuum of silence. Most of the faithful left on Pacham would have Father Duray as our true pope. I look at the elderly Jesuit. I have been through enough that it does not make me all tingly to be in the presence of a legend, someone who was central to the Kontos. As is always the case when you are with the actual human being behind the celebrity or legend, there is something human about the man or woman that makes things less than myth. In this case, it is the soft tufts of gray hair growing in the priest's large ears. Teilhard the Second, I say, remembering that the man had reportedly been a fine pope as Teilhard the First 279 years ago, for a short period before he was murdered for the first time. Duray accepts more wine from Father DeSoya and shakes his head. I can see that the sadness behind those large eyes is the same as DeSoya's, earned and heartfelt, not assumed for character effect. "No more papacy for me," he says. "I will spend the rest of my years attempting to learn from Aeneas' teachings, listening very hard for the voices of the dead and the living, while reacquainting myself with our Lord's lessons on humility. For years I played the archaeologist and intellectual. It is time to rediscover myself as a simple parish priest." "Amen," says DeSoya, and hunts in his cupboard for another bottle. The former Pax starship captain sounds a bit drunk. "You don't wear the cruciform any longer?" I say, addressing myself to all three men while looking at Duray. All three of them look shocked. Duray says, "Only the fools and ultimately cynical still wear the parasite role. Very few on Pacham. Very few on any of the worlds where Nia's shared moment was heard." He touches his thin chest as if remembering. "It was not a choice for me, actually. I was reborn in one of the Vatican resurrection creches at the height of the fighting. I waited for Lord Asami and Albedo to visit me as always, to murder me as always. Instead, this man..." He extends his long fingers toward Key, who bows slightly and pours himself a bit more wine. "This man," continues the former Pope Teilhard, "came crashing in with his rebels, all combat armor and ancient rifles. He brought me a chalice of wine. I knew what it was. I had shared in the shared moment." I stare at the old priest. Even dormant in the bubble memory matrix of the extra cruciform, even while being resurrected, I thought. As if reading my gaze, Father Duray nods. "Even there," he says. Looking directly at me, he says, "What will you do now, Rol Endymion?" I hesitate only a moment. "I came to Pacham to find Aeneas' ashes. She asked me. She once asked." "We know, my son," says Father DeSoya quietly. "Anyway, I go on when I can. There's no chance of that in what's left of Castel Sant'Angelo, so I'll continue with my other priority." "Which is?" says Father Duray with infinite gentleness. Suddenly, in this dim room with the rough table and the old wine and the male smell of clean sweat all around, I can see in the old Jesuit the powerful reality behind Uncle Martin's mythic cantos. I realize without doubt that this was indeed the man of faith who had crucified himself not once but repeated times on the lightning-filled Tesla tree rather than submit to the false cross of the cruciform. This was a true defender of the faith. This was a man whom Aeneas would have loved to have met and talked with and debated with. At that moment, I feel her loss with such renewed pain that I have to look down into my wine to hide my eyes from Duray and the others. "Aeneas once told me that she had given birth to a child," I managed to say and then stop. I cannot remember if this fact had been in the gestalt of memories and thoughts that was transmitted in Aeneas' shared moment. If so, they know all about this. I glance at them, but both priests and the corporal are waiting politely. They had not known this. "I'm going to find that child," I say. "Find it and help raise it, if I am allowed." The priests look at one another in something like wonderment. Key is looking at me. "We did not know this," says Federico DeSoya. "I am amazed. I would have wagered everything I know about human nature to say that you were the only man in her life, the only love. I have never seen two young people so happy." "There was someone else," I say, raising my glass almost violently to swig down the last of the wine, only to find the glass empty. I set it carefully on the table. "There was someone else," I say again, less miserably and emphatically this time. "But that's not important. The baby, the child, is important. I want to find it if I can." "Do you have any idea where the child is?" says Key. I sigh and shake my head. "None. But I'll cast to every world in the old Pax and Outback, to every world in the galaxy if I have to, beyond the galaxy. I stop. I am drunk, and this is too important to talk about when drunk. Anyway, that's where I'll be going in a few minutes. Father DeSoya shakes his head. You're exhausted, Rawl. Spend the night here. Basson has an extra cot in his house next door. We will all sleep tonight and see you off in the morning. Have to go now, I say, and start to rise, to show them my ability to think straight and act decisively. The room tilts as if the ground has subsided suddenly on the south side of Father DeSoya's little house. I grab the table for support, almost miss it, and hang on.
Perhaps the morning would be best, says Father DeRay, standing and putting a strong hand on my shoulder.
Yes, I say, standing again and finding the ground tremors subsiding slightly.
Tomorrow's better.
I shake all of their hands again. Twice. I am desperately close to crying again, not from grief this time, although the grief is there, always in the background like the symphony of the spheres, but out of sheer relief at their company. I have been alone for so long now.
Come, friend, says former Corporal Basson Key of the Pax Marines and the Corps Helvetica, putting his hand on my other shoulder and walking with the former Pope Teyard and me to his little room, where I collapse onto one of the two cots there. I am drifting away when I feel someone pulling off my boots. I think it is the former Pope.
I had forgotten that Pacham has only a 19 standard hour day. The nights are too short. In the morning, I am still suffused with the exhilaration of my freedom. But my head hurts, my back hurts, my stomach aches, my teeth hurt, my hair hurts. And I am sure that a pack of small, fuzzy creatures has taken up residence in the back of my mouth. The village beyond the chapel is bustling with early morning activity, all of it too loud. Cook fires simmer. Women and children go about chores, while the men emerge from the simple homes with the same stubbled, red-eyed, roadkill expression that I know I am giving to the world. The priests are in good form, however. I watch a dozen or so parishioners leave the chapel and realize that both DeSoya and DeRay have celebrated an early mass while I was snoring. Basson Key comes by, greets me in much too loud a voice, and shows me a small structure that is the men's washhouse. Plumbing consists of cold water pumped to an overhead reservoir that one can spill onto oneself in one quick, bone marrow freezing second of shower. The morning is Pacham cool, much like mornings at the 8,000-meter altitude on Tian Shan, and the shower wakes me up very quickly. Key has brought clean new clothes for me, softened corduroy work trousers, a finely spun blue wool shirt, thick belt, and sturdy shoes that are infinitely more comfortable than the boots I have stubbornly worn for more than a standard year in the Schrodinger cat box. Shaven, clean, wearing different clothes, holding a steaming mug of coffee that Key's young bride has handed me, the scriber hanging from a strap over my shoulder, I feel like a new man. My first thought at this swell of well-being is, Ania would love this fresh morning. And the clouds obscure the sunlight for me again. Fathers DeRay and DeSoya join me on a large rock overlooking the Absinthe River. The rubble of the Vatican looks like a ruin from ancient days. I see the windshields of moving ground cars glinting in the sharp morning light and catch a glimpse of the occasional EMV flying high above the wrecked city and realize again that this is not another fall. Even Pacham has not been dropped back into barbarism. Key had explained that the morning coffee had been shipped in by transport from the largely untouched agricultural cities in the west. The Vatican and the ruins of the administrative cities here are more of a localized disaster area, rather like survivors choosing to rebuild in the wake of a regional earthquake or hurricane. Key joins us again with several warm breakfast rolls, and the four of us eat in agreeable silence, occasionally brushing crumbs away and sipping our coffee as the sun rises higher behind us, catching the many columns of smoke from campfires and cookstoves. I'm trying to understand this new way of looking at things, I say at last. You're isolated here on Pacham compared to the days of the Pax Empire, but you're still aware of what's going on elsewhere, on other worlds. Father DeSoya nods. Just as you can touch the void to listen to the language of the living, so can we reach out to those we know and care for. For instance, this morning I touched the thoughts of Sergeant Gregorius on Mare Infinitus. I had also heard Gregorius's distinctive thoughts while listening to the music of the spheres before freecasting. But I say, is he well? He is well, says DeSoya. The poachers and smugglers and deep-sea rebels on that world quickly isolated the few Pax loyalists, although the fighting between various Pax outposts did much damage to many of the civilian platforms. Gregorius has become sort of a local mayor or governor for the mid-littoral region. Quite in opposition to his wishes, I might add. The sergeant was never interested in command. He would have been an officer many years ago if he had been. Speaking of command, I say, who's in charge of all this? I gesture at the ruins, the distant highway with its moving vehicles, the EMV transport coming in toward the east bank. Actually, the entire Pacham system is under the temporary governorship of a former Pax Mercantilis CEO named Kenzo Isozaki, says Father DeSoya. His headquarters is in the ruins of the old Taurus Mercantilis, but he visits the planet frequently. I show my surprise at this. Isozaki, I say? The last I saw of him in preparing my narrative, he was involved in the attack on the Star Tree biosphere. He was, agrees DeSoya. But that attack was still underway when the shared moment occurred. There was much confusion. Elements of the Pax fleet rallied to lure Dusami and his ilk, while other elements, some led by Kenzo Isozaki, who held the title of commander of the Order of the Knights of Jerusalem, fought to stop the carnage. The loyalists kept most of the Archangel starships, since they could not be used without resurrection. Isozaki brought more than 100 of the older Hawking Drive starships back to Pacham system and drove off the last of the core attackers. Is he a dictator? I ask, not caring too much if he is. It is not my problem. Not at all, says Key. Isozaki is running things temporarily with the help of elected governing councils from each of the Pacham cantons. He's excellent at arranging logistics, which we need. In the meantime, the local areas are running things fairly well. It's the first time there has ever been a real democracy in this system. It's sloppy, but it works. I think that Isozaki is helping to shape a sort of capitalist with a conscience trading system for the days when we begin moving freely through old Pax space. By freecasting, I say? All three of the men nod. I shake my head again. It is hard to imagine the near future. Billions, hundreds of billions, of people free to move from world to world without spacecraft or farcaster. Hundreds of billions able to contact each other by touching the void with their hearts and minds. It will be like the height of the hegemony world web days without the core facade of farcaster portals and fatline transmitters. No, I realize at once. It will not be like the hegemony days at all. It will be something completely different, something unprecedented in human experience. Ania has changed everything forever. Are you leaving today, Roll? Asks Father DeRay in his soft French accent. As soon as I finish this fine coffee. The sun is growing warm on my bare arms and neck. Where will you go? Asks Father DeSoya. I start to answer and then stop. I realize that I have no idea. Where do I look for Aeneas' child? What if the observer has taken the boy or girl to some distant system that I cannot reach by casting? What if they have returned to old Earth? Can I actually free-cast 160,000 light-years? Aeneas did. But she may have had the help of the lions and tigers and bears. Will I someday be able to hear those voices in the complex chorus of the void? It all seems too large and vague and irrelevant to me. I don't know where I'm going, I hear myself saying in the voice of a lost boy. I was going to old Earth because of Aeneas' wish that I... her ashes. But, embarrassed at showing emotion again, I wave at the mountain of melted stone that had been Castel Sant'Angelo. Maybe I'll go back to Hyperion, I say. See Martin Silenus. Before he dies, I add silently. All of us stand on the boulder, pouring out the last drops of cold coffee from the mugs and brushing away the last crumbs from the delicious rolls. I am suddenly struck by an obvious thought. "Do any of you want to come with me?" I say. "Or go anywhere else, for that matter?" I think that I will remember how to freecast. And Ania took us with her just by holding the person's hand. No, she freecast the entire Yggdrasil with her just by willing it. "If you are going to Hyperion," says Father de Soya, "I may wish to accompany you. But first I have something to show you. Excuse us, Father Duray. Basson." I follow the short priest back to the village and into his little church. In the tiny sacristy, barely large enough for a wooden wardrobe cupboard for vestments and the small secondary altar in which to store the sacramental hosts and wine, de Soya pushes back a curtain on a small alcove and removes a short metal cylinder, smaller than a coffee thermos. He holds it out to me and I am reaching for it, my fingers just centimeters away, when suddenly I freeze in mid-motion, unable to touch it. "Yes," says the priest. "Ania's ashes. What we could recover. Not much, I am afraid." My fingers trembling. Still unable to touch the dull metal cylinder, I stammer. "How? When?" "Before the final core attack," de Soya says softly. "Some of us who liberated the prisoners thought it prudent to remove our young friend's cremated remains. There are actually those who wanted to find them and hold them as holy relics. The start of another cult. I felt strongly that Ania would not have wished that. Was I correct, Rawl?" "Yes," I say, my hand shaking visibly now. I am still unable to touch the cylinder and almost unable to speak. "Yes, absolutely, completely," I say vehemently. "She would have hated that. She would have cursed at the thought. I can't tell you how many times she and I discussed the tragedy of Buddha's followers treating him like a god and his remains as relics. The Buddha also asked that his body be cremated and his ashes scattered so that..." I have to stop there. "Yes," says de Soya. He pulls a black canvas shoulder bag from his cupboard and sets the cylinder in it. He shoulders the bag. "If you would like, I could bring this with us if we are to travel together." "Thank you," is all I can say. I cannot reconcile the life and energy and skin and flashing eyes and clean female scent of Ania, her touch and laugh and voice and hair and ultimate physical presence with that small metal cylinder. I lower my hand before the priest can see how badly it is shaking. "Are you ready to go?" I say at last. De Soya nods. "Please allow me to tell a few of my village friends that I will be absent for a few days. Would it be possible for you to drop me off here later on your way, wherever you go?" I blink at that. Of course it will be possible. I had thought of my leave-taking today as final, an interstellar voyage. But Pacham, as everywhere else in the known universe, will never be farther than a step away for me as long as I live. If I remember how to hear the music of the spheres and freecast again, if I can take someone with me, if it was not a one-time gift which I have lost without knowing it. Now my entire frame is shaking. I tell myself it is just too much coffee and say raggedly, "Yeah, no problem. I'll go chat with Father Duray and Basson until you're ready." The old Jesuit and the young soldier are at the edge of a small cornfield, arguing about whether it is the optimum time.